is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grillion Bunker, welcome again. It is the Grillion Report, and I am your host, Micah Hanks. Always honored to be your host on this program. Things may be a tinge less creepy than they were last week, but nonetheless esoteric, nonetheless strange, enlightening, enlivening, perhaps. Welcome to the program. It is the Grillion Report, and I'm Micah Hanks, your host, along with the co-host of the program, the producer extraordinaire, Mr. Tyler Pittman. Good evening, Goblin Slave. How are you?
Doing well. Good evening to all of you out there listening.
Yes, indeed. We're seeing the chat room is filling up, so we'll give folks a few minutes to get in here. You know, fashionably late. That's the way to do things these days. But boy, have we got a lot to talk about tonight. Kraken theories, the box of crazy, missions to Mars, the LAX shooter conspiracy. Boy, I'm almost ashamed that we have to talk about shooting conspiracies anymore on this program. We've heard so much about that already this year, and yet there's so much more to discuss, as you shall soon see. And then during hour two, James Swagger is going to be joining us. He's the author of the Newgrange Serious Mystery. He's also a radio host, and he's going to be talking about, well, what we were kind of inspired to discuss last week by virtue of the holiday, Halloween, but going all the way back to the ancient rituals of yesteryear. We'll be talking a little bit about the Samhain. Samhain. How do you pronounce it again, Tyler?
Samhain.
Samhain. Yeah, you know, again, I'm from the South. Come on, give me a break here.
Didn't Danzig have a band for a while called Samhain? I think that's what
how
it's pronounced.
Well, Samhain is how it's written, but Samhain is apparently how it's pronounced. James will cue us on that pronunciation, the proper pronunciation, being a good Irishman. And so, in the spirit of the season now, Guinness, okay, has released a seasonal that is actually a Samhain-inspired brew, which really tastes an awful lot like their regular Guinness stout. But we're going to celebrate Samhain. We're going to celebrate our Irish guest, and we're going to have a Guinness on the air tonight with James Swagger during hour two, who I guarantee, in addition to being just an all-around good chap, will be a fascinating guest just as well. Now, there they are. Look, there we go. I think the chat room participation has doubled just in the last two sentences that I've begun to speak. Getting right to a little bit of news in New Delhi, India. Just today, India launched its first spacecraft bound for the red planet of Mars, a complex mission described by USA Today earlier today as one that they hope will demonstrate and advance technologies for space travel put forth by India. Now, hundreds of people watched the rocket carrying the Mars orbiter as it took off from the east coast island of Sriharikota. And it struck across the sky. Many more across the country watched the live TV broadcasts. Now, officials at the Space Center described it as a textbook launch. If the mission is successful, India will become only the fourth nation to visit the red planet, vicariously through robotics, we should add, after the Soviet Union, the United States, and, of course, Europe. Capturing and igniting the young minds of India and across the globe will be the major return from this mission, according to the director, P. Kunistarishyan, and the launch site. Now, after 44 minutes, orbiter separated from the rocket and entered into an elliptical path around Earth. Over the next 20 to 25 days, it will perform a series of technical maneuvers and short burns to raise its orbit before the slingshot, as it's called, toward Mars. You know, the funny thing about slingshots, Tyler, is that when you pull the rubber band back, okay, the forces of physics take it from you and launch things forward as quickly as they've come backward. And in the case of one program that we're about to discuss, perhaps things as quickly as they go forward also retreat and go backward. Tyler dropped a little bombshell on me tonight just as we were taking the airwaves. Now, the Grillion Report, what are we? We're in our third year, and I think we'll be beginning our fourth, if I remember correctly. In my old age, I do forget these things from time to time, but we'll be beginning our fourth year sometime in early March or April, I suppose, of 2014. Correct me if I'm wrong now, Tyler, because, again, in my old age, in addition to having memory lapses, perhaps my hearing has gotten bad, but did you tell me that the Dark Matter radio program that Art Bell has been hosting on Sirius is no longer a program?
Yes.
What?
I know. I heard about it last night. I guess it was around 9 p.m., maybe 10 p.m., somewhere in there.
Okay. What happened?
From what I gather...
Wait, first, let me ask, who did you hear this from?
It was... Where did I first hear it from? It was a media outlet of some sort, and I cannot recall now. And
I was almost afraid to ask if it was Art talking about this.
I think Art tweeted it, because I think how it got out is the guest he was supposed to have on live that night, the show, it was canceled, and they did a rerun. So I think it somehow leaked from that guy, and then Art himself put out a tweet, and it was picked up.
So what's the gist of the story here?
Ultimately, I believe that Art was having issues with callers calling in on cell phones while traveling, and that's one thing he said. And the other thing...
I mean, are you talking about, like, audio quality issues?
Well, that's what was written. And then the second part, because these things don't really relate in my mind,
right,
is Art was requesting of Sirius the ability to stream free for 1 year through his domain or something such as, and I guess that resulted in the ending of the show.
Listen, this is something I had thought from day one might end up being a problem if they weren't careful about the way that they proceeded with this. Art Bell and his listenership, you know, they're used to being able to tune in the evenings and listen to Art Bell every night. And that's the first issue that I saw coming out of a program with Sirius Satellite Radio was I was thinking, you know, immediately they're going to have the hurdle of getting around the fact that it's a subscriber-only program. Second of all, most people who listen to satellite radio arguably are listening in their cars while driving along, which I
right.
presume is the issue with the cell phones, because people are, you know, calling in from cell phones while driving, which, if you think about it, I mean, might even bring in something along the lines of, you know, a safety hazard. Now, Red Pill Junkie in the chat room is already saying not audio quality, it was audience numbers. But again, that comes back to the very point I'm stressing here, that you have a very limited audience with Sirius Satellite Radio. Yes, the benefit of satellite radio is that your audience is going to be, the benefit that they will get is if, as subscribers to Sirius Satellite Radio, yeah, you're going to get commercial free. But then again, Art being used to a clock that's one thing I noticed when I began listening, because I said, I'm going to get satellite radio just so that I can listen to this program. I have to say, with all due respect to the man himself, you know, the program is not what it was when he was doing Coast back in the day. And frankly, as a talk radio listener, as a longtime producer of talk radio, and as a host of three programs on a weekly basis myself, you know, one of the issues I had with that was that hearing Art doing that longer format with fewer breaks, I mean, everyone considers this a good thing, but in my way of thinking, and a lot of people argue this with me, but Tyler, I maintain that this is the benefit of the podcast, is that a podcast can be an audio recording with a conversation or an interview or something like that, but it doesn't have to sound like a radio show. But I enjoy the pacing of a radio program, commercials and all. A lot of people complain about that. To me, it's just a matter of that's a different medium. If I'm listening to a podcast, I enjoy no commercial interruptions, but I'm not going to complain about hearing commercials on a radio program like some people do complain about fast-forwarding through them. You know, this program, the Graylian Report, has always had a radio-type format. We've got, you know, three breaks per hour and then a longer top-of-the-hour break, and the reason why is because I have a background in talk radio, and I wanted this program to sound more like that. The Micah Hanks program has a different format because we're on KGRA, and so therefore the KGRA rules apply, but nonetheless it's still a formatted kind of program with commercials. If anything, the commercial breaks are a little longer, but there are fewer of them, and therefore there are longer talk segments, which is, I think, the genius of Mr. Race Hobbs, our program director there in Kansas City, and a good friend of the program as well. God, we should get Race on the show sometime. But then again, as a producer and a program director, he's often very busy on the nights that we broadcast. And then there's the Middle Theory program, the brand new show that we're talking about, that if you like this show and if you like hearing maybe the sort of the mixed bag that you get with Tyler and I on Sunday nights, a good friend of the program, Christopher McCollum, is the co-host of Middle Theory. And if you tune into that show, you're going to hear a little less paranormal, actually virtually no paranormal, but you're going to hear some conspiracy. You're definitely going to hear news and politics and this sort of thing. And so I think that we've got all the bases covered now between the three programs that the Graylian Gang are putting out. But what I like about Middle Theory is that it's a podcast and there aren't commercial interruptions. What I don't like about not having commercial interruptions is fewer breaks to be able to run to the restroom because we know that radio broadcasters have to remain hydrated.
Yes, that's why we have our big Berkey water filter right at arm's length.
Yes.
And do you have some pollen burst over there?
Yeah, man. Yeah, I've got actually, this is Beyond Tangy Tangerine right here that I've been trying just today, and immediately I've noticed that my appetite has reduced. I feel more nourished, but I'm just kidding. No, let's not even go there. Anyway.
But I was going to make the point, or just mention, I think when I first started listening to radio, you kind of become conditioned to hearing ads every now and then. On AM radio, where I was first introduced to Art Bell, they have the AshevilleJobsWanted.com or whatever. You know what I mean? It's just, but the bumpers are what's magical for me. It kind of gets you in that mood and then teases you a little bit. And there's always like a theme with it.
That's something else to think about, Tyler. For instance, people who always complain about commercials in broadcasts. Well, what happens when you listen to a podcast and there are no bumpers? There's no music. You know, see, the thing is that the radio format, people may not like advertisements, but to me, having to hear ads and the intro and outro music, the stingers, the stunners, the tasers, all the different little things in radio speak that constitute what we call a show, a program, I like that, you know, and I like the podcast without all that just as well, but I consider them two completely different mediums. And people, you know, I've even had this talk with Race at KGRA. He's like, you know, the podcasters, man, they need to understand they're undermining radio. And I've said, you know, I don't know that that's necessarily the case. They are two different mediums. That's why I do one podcast now that with Middle Theory is a straight podcast, although we do broadcast it live, but then again, a lot of the podcasts do that. We do broadcast it live, but it's no commercials. It is a podcast. The Micah Hanks program that you and I do on Sunday nights, it's a radio program. I mean, we stream it live. It's not as podcast-friendly, unfortunately, but we've gotten some complaints about that. And what I mean by not as podcast-friendly is that it's not available through iTunes and things like that. So Graylian meets in the middle. You know, Graylian is a live broadcast. Graylian is also an iTunes-friendly program. But also, we hit that inevitable problem that a lot of broadcasters hit, which is how do you monetize something like that that has the jurisdictions of the podcast realm, but also which has to convene in the radio game with breaks, with the broadcast and all these things. It's interesting.
Right.
And so to me, it's important to be able to delineate between the two. Satellite radio is kind of its own thing. It's got its own podcast-esque commercial-free idea, which is implemented only through a subscriber base, which limits, obviously, the listenership, and also because of the prominence of people listening in their cars. Yes, as Art seemed to have said, the cell phone may have been. I would consider that a pretty small issue.
And I think RPJ in the chat mentioned it. And now I do recall reading a more in depth story. This is how I heard about it: allaccess.com, I'm not even familiar with.
Are you
the
changing
website.
Your story?
No, I just
you're changing your story.
My memory.
No, hold on. Let me stop you right there. You're changing your story. I'm just going to call you Tyler Barack Obama Pittman tonight.
Just look it up and see for yourself that my story it fills out. But he was talking about it being widely pirated. And things being different than they used to be in the
old
days.
It was widely pirated, though. Man, dude, the episodes were all over YouTube. But now, look, let me ask you something. If he had been doing a coast-to-coast type show, would it have not been pirated? Now, the problem, again, here is that when people are required to pay for it, the pirating becomes an issue because if someone can find a free episode, they're not going to subscribe. See, I'm not saying that the Sirius model is flawed, but what I am saying is that I don't think a guy like Art Bell, coming from a terrestrial AM-heavy radio broadcast program with millions of listeners, would translate well going straight to Sirius.
Right, it's kind of a niche market.
Yeah, it really is, yeah.
I say we just put Art Bell back in the seat at Coast to Coast.
Yeah, but you remember what he said. You know, there was a Time Magazine article about that, and it literally said, "Not a chance in hell." And that's exactly what he has said, and that is, I guarantee you he would never go back. Now, I also have to say this. He's also said some very harsh things about Coast to Coast. And I'm not exaggerating when I say...
Like what?
He said some harsh things, like he hates what they've done. He hates everything that Coast to Coast stands for. Look, I'll tell you this.
Well, before you do, I will say I use the TuneIn app frequently to listen to...
Coast?
Both Ground Zero and Coast to Coast. KGRA is on there as well. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed recently KGRA has become iTunes friendly. You may not be able to get the podcast, but if you look under the radio tab in your iTunes, you can find it.
Yeah, we're streaming, yeah.
Just throw that thing in a playlist. which I do for radio. See, and I have all the different radio stations I, you know.
That's the problem, though. Everybody wants listening on demand, which, by the way, I mean, there are going to be some big changes with KGRA. I guarantee you, by around the beginning of the next year, maybe we'll just call it a New Year's resolution, and it's not necessarily mine, but I think I am within the jurisdiction to be able to speak on behalf of the KGRA and say there are going to be some big changes. So I think the iTunes and the app and the podcasting issues are going to be nil, because in order to be able to exist and to survive in this market, paranormal talk radio, you have to be able to meet all these requirements. You have to be able to provide enough for free that people will want to listen, but enough for pay that you can profit in order to keep the operation afloat.
Right.
You also have to be able to be podcast friendly, but in being podcast friendly, you have to be able to provide enough content for the podcast, but not overreach FCC compliance, ASCAP, BMI. A lot of people outside radio don't even know what these things mean, but essentially, if you're going to play licensed music by artists, popular music on your program, you can't do that on a podcast. Now, funny enough, I looked into this. I think that there are actually licenses for podcasters. The problem is in order to be able to get BMI and ASCAP certification so that I could play Thriller by Michael Jackson during a Halloween episode like last week, I mean, it's an exorbitant cost for people who are on a budget like we are.
Right.
And so that's the whole thing. You know, that's one of the reasons that we enjoy doing a radio program on KGRA is that we get to use popular radio music and run it like a radio show. So it's a really complex thing. Hey, look at this. Red Pill Junkie is saying nerds. But, I mean, the truth, I don't know if he's talking about us or if they're just having their own conversation. You know, the chat room kind of has its own thing. Yeah, they've kind of got their own thing going on. Yeah, okay, so we're being podcast, radio, junkie, nerd, whatever. But it's an important conversation. Anybody out there in the listening audience, if I'm annoying you, go ahead and fast forward to the end of the next break where we'll be talking about the LEX shooting. Boy, that's a convert. You know, as a matter of fact, actually, we should just go on to the break because I want to get to that, and we're going to run out of time if we keep talking about this. It's just Tyler threw a curveball at me. I had no idea.
I was surprised you didn't hear about this. And
dude, I live in a bunker underground. When am I supposed to hear about this sort of stuff?
I'm really not sure. I was just going to say the last episode of Coast to Coast I listened to on TuneIn had to deal with making your own survival garden. How interesting.
Well, you know, see, again, Coast to Coast is having to cater, I think, to a broader audience by incorporating new themes, which Art Bell hated. He'd never go back to Coast to Coast. And I'm going to tell you this.
No, they just want to plug that survival seed bowl.
Coast to Coast, though, man, Tom Danhauser and George. George was at Paradigm last year. They're good people. They're friends of the program. I tell you, they've taken the high road. I'm sad to see Art go, but I think I saw it coming. Look, we'll be back right after this. It's the Mike and Hanks Graylian Report. Stay with us.
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by. Never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal. Wounded Warrior Project was created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war, whether those scars are physical or mental. Wounded Warrior Project. We never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Learn more about what we do at woundedwarriorproject.org.
Welcome back to the program. It is the Graylian Report. Tyler and I, keeping abreast of the news during the break and almost coming back late to the primary broadcast, but we love you too much to do that to you. I'm trying to say hi to everybody in the chat room. Justin, MIB Jr., Nikki, Ninja, Nuvina, Red Pill Junkie, Roar. Oh, there's so many I can't even keep up with it. Belgarian.
I think I saw a few of you in the Richard Dolan chat last night.
Uh-oh. Rich, I love Richard Dolan. We got to get Richard.
Yeah, he's got a good program.
Richard has a great program. Richard Dolan is one of my favorite people. That's another thing I love about being on KGRA. Chase Kletsky, Scotty, and John, of course, with Intrepid Radio. Rich Dolan. Man, Rich and I, back in February at the Congress, we hit it off. It was so funny because his wife, Karen, came up to me, and she said, you know, Rich really wants to meet you. I'm like, yeah, right, you're being really nice. And I walked by his table, and as I'm walking by his table, Rich goes, he like waves me down. He's like, hey. And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, hey, Micah. I'm like, hey, Richard. We should really get introduced. And so we ended up, like, a bunch of us, he and David Weatherly and I, a bunch of us went and had, like, a hot dog in the casino that night.
Hot dog.
And his plan was, since he had to do a live broadcast from the program, or from the Congress, he wanted to have a bunch of people sit in on the show. And after he and I kind of talked a little, he's like, you know, why don't you just come up there and let's just do the show, just you and I. And we did. And, you know, I've told this story before. There's this one moment where I was discussing the way that I think that entropy and time relate to the potential for time travel and also how that could all tie in with UFOs. And he didn't see where I was going with it. And so I broke it all down.
I don't either.
Well, I should tell you sometime. I could be a guest on my own program. But I was discussing this, and Rich, at this point, he puts his hands on his head like this and he goes, oh my God, I think you just blew my mind. And
you gave Richard an aneurysm?
Rich said one of the nicest things to me that anyone has ever said. I'm sitting there in a hotel room broadcasting on his show, and Rich is sitting, literally, we were sharing a microphone, so we were sitting like a foot away from each other, and Rich Dolan goes, wow. He said, you're not a genius, but you are brilliant. And that was one of the most sincere comments. I mean, it was so honest, you know? You're not a genius, but you are brilliant. And then after the program, he told me, he says, you know, my whole plan is to surround myself with brilliant young people like you so that, you know, when I get really old, you know, I'll have all my groupies and stuff. And I said, you don't even have to ask. He's the only guy in terms of ufological studies, to the way that I see things. Rich is the only other guy who gets it. And with all due respect to other ufologists, because we all have different opinions. So that's completely a self-centered statement in terms of my own ideological perspectives toward ufology. But from where I look at ufology, he's the guy, he's the one who, in terms of like my circle of peeps, he's the one who gets it. And I have unending support, admiration, and respect for Rich Dolan. He is the guy. Anyway, 14 in Mind says, I'd like to hear Micah interview Micah. two of me would be too much. Which is why we say two. Welcome back to the program. It is the Graylian Report. Now, as we promised, we want to get to a little discussion about the LAX shooting. You know, I didn't even think about this earlier. I've heard about it all weekend, and this is actually going to illustrate a point, Tyler. I didn't even want to talk about this on the program tonight, not because I didn't want to talk about it, but because, well, I hadn't even thought to talk about it. Truly, think about this. Think about the fact that I hadn't even thought to think about talking about this. Okay.
It's not hard to believe you're a mind-controlled meat puppet.
I am. Yeah, well, a candied meat puppet, bobbing for candied meat in a commode, remember?
I do.
By the way, we've gotten so many compliments from people on the Halloween edition. We really, on this program in general, we kind of like to just let loose and just tell it how it is. But by the same token, take the open-minded perspective, middle theory approach to everything. But I tell you, last week, that was a lot of fun. Just sitting around the campfire together, you know, eating candied apples or whatever Tyler was in there bobbing in the toilet for. Just having fun. That's what this is really all about. You got to have fun when you're doing this stuff. But
pleasure spheres.
Which is maybe part of the reason I didn't want to get into the LAX shooting. Because don't get me wrong, I was at a friend's house the other night, and they had, don't laugh, they had Fox News on in the background. And I'm not bashing Fox News any more than I bash any of them. You got to understand, when I talk about it like that, I'm not taking the other side. You got to keep in mind, well, ideologically, in the center where I am, I laugh at all of them. I make fun of all of them. And I also recognize the few times where I see good information coming from any of these sources. And I'm not going to attack Fox News any more or any less than I attack MSNBC, CNN, Headline News. You know, CNN used to be the moderate source. They're not that anymore. BBC kind of used to be that. They're not that anymore. Hell, who can you go to for a moderate perspective?
There's no such thing.
There is no such thing, and that's the point. And see, Tyler, God, that this is why we do a program together, two programs a week, because you understand that.
Not to interrupt you, I'm one of the belief that Fox News is actually, I'm forgetting the term now that I interjected, you know, controlled opposition.
Controlled opposition.
I feel like it's just something there to make Democrats look good, because you have to admit some of the coverage on Fox News is laughable.
Well, it is because it's designed to appeal to a certain demographic. But by the same token, I also will I'll tell you this: when I have access to a television and I've got cable, you will not catch me watching MSNBC. I will only watch typically CNN and Fox News, fully aware of the filter that needs to be applied. We're going to be hearing a few sound bites from. Incidentally, we do not have Fox News here, but we do have a CNN sound clip and then a few others. There's one from CBS as well. These all pertain to the LAX shooting. Now, the reason I bring this to the discussion here is because over the weekend, I was not woefully, blissfully unaware of what was going on. The LAX shooting was only one of two that occurred over the weekend. There was another one in New Jersey that involved this guy who went into a shopping mall. They found him apparently this morning, and he had killed himself with a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head this morning.
This was last night that the story broke around. I was, like I said, it's around the same time I heard the Art Bell announcement. This came in, and I kind of followed it just to see what was going on. And I'm like, the mall is open at 10 p.m. for this guy to come in?
Some malls might be. I know that Christmas hours, a lot of malls around here, for instance, close at 9, but they're open until 10 or later for Christmas hours. And following Halloween and leading up to Thanksgiving, and then, of course, Christmas, the big shopping holiday. Yeah, it may not be unusual for malls to be open that late. By the same token, the mall may not have been technically open. He could have gone in before then, and they may have been trying to find the shooter. Any number of things could have happened, but they found him holed up in a back room in one of the shops, and he had killed himself, shot himself in the head. Now, the important thing here to keep in mind is, with all this discussion of media, I was not unaware of the fact that a shooting occurred, and yet by the same token, it didn't even register, because I try not to just go after all this stuff. And on this program, that's another thing, too. I think that the only way that I can really be true to the kind of content that generally people who listen to this program would like to hear, which is esoteric, 4TN, conspiracy definitely fits into what we do, and it's even in the headline, and it always has been. Conspiracy is a big part of this program, but I don't think people like to hear the overt politics. As much as I'd like to talk about what's going on in Virginia as the primary, and that's what we were debating, Tyler and I, during the break, as much as I'd like to talk about that right now on this show, that's not going to be topic A. It's topic A for everybody else, which is the reason why we're not talking about it on Graylian Report. This listenership wants to hear what this show is always supposed to have been about, which is the unexplained, essentially. And that doesn't definitely include conspiracy talk and things like that. So all that said, when I was hearing about shootings going on over the weekend, I was not thinking, oh, this is going to be what we'll talk about on Graylian. It wasn't even what we talked about this morning, McNonymous and I, on Middle Theory. It would be more the kind of thing we would maybe talk about on the Sunday program, and yet then we get in the studio. Tyler and I are doing our show prep this afternoon, and we're seeing all these NWO references coming out. So let's go ahead and get to the audio with regard to this LAX shooting thing. Again, I want you to understand, people, and the reason why we've kind of put this great big lead in here, I know a lot of people probably just perceive it as rambling, but we have to phrase this, and it's important to do so in the context of, okay, this is the mainstream media. This is the reason why I tune it out, because I'm hearing what the mainstream is talking about this stuff. I'm at a friend's house Saturday night. They've got Fox News on in the background. I'm hearing about the shooting, and I'm thinking the last thing I want to hear about. First of all, people are becoming completely desensitized when they hear about a shooting.
Right. That's kind of like a big tack that pokes me every time I hear about it. I'm like, what is the point? And the one that happened last night is kind of interesting because no one was shot. I think the initial reports were talking about up to five gunmen, yet they found one spent shell case.
That's what it always is. They always say there could be more shooters, and it's always whittled down after the fact. You know, so you begin to start seeing these trends emerge. I think that's another important thing. But then finally, of course, what we also want to say is that much like the Navy Yard shooting. God, I tell you, there have been so many, it is hard to keep up with them. Much like, no, it was the Navy Yard shooting. Yeah, in Washington. Yeah.
Yeah, the 6-week cycle. That was that's
Aaron
the
Alexis
thing that coincides with the Lack shooting. That's probably the only reason we're really talking about it is for the listeners out there. I believe it was No Agenda that first sourced the 6-week cycle thing.
Who's No Agenda? Oh, Adam Curry and
right, a podcast that our listeners should be familiar with.
Some of them probably are. You know, I mean, hell, I'll tell you this. It's hard not to do a podcast and know who Adam Curry is. Unfortunately, I don't get to listen to a lot of podcasts. But for those who don't know, that's, okay, who it is.
But they got their information supposedly from an insider at the FBI. And they nail it every time.
You mentioned, by the way, you mentioned Clyde Lewis earlier. And Clyde, with that Navy Yard shooting, he was pretty onto some interesting, what we might call synchromystical elements that come together. In other words, elements that have to do with synchronicities and strange coincidences that occur in conjunction with the actual act being discussed. You're going to see that a lot here with regard to the LAX shooter. Let's start with a timeline. Let's go ahead and get right into it because I think we've defined exactly why we're talking about it. We've put it into the context of, okay, yeah, you're going to be hearing from the mainstream media. We tried to tune this out at first. You almost can't, and here's why. But we'll start with this timeline, and as we get into this, you're going to hear that people are asserting NWO conspiracies more and more, and then everything right down to the shooter's last name gets into the realm of the synchromystical to the point that it's almost difficult to overlook this stuff. Here, we begin with a timeline, what happened according to CNN News.
Los Angeles International Airport, 9:20 a.m. local time. The FBI says Paul Anthony Ciancia, a 23-year-old white male, enters Terminal 3, pulls a rifle from a bag.
Remember that name, Ciancia.
At the security checkpoint, TSA officers who are not armed are shot. One is killed.
He proceeded up into the screening area where TSA screeners are and continued shooting and went past the screeners back into the airport itself.
Authorities say after shooting his way through the security checkpoint, the gunman manages to make it all the way down this hallway. They say he's stopped by authorities here near a Burger King in the food court area. Hundreds run for their lives.
It was a complete panic. People were screaming. I saw children crying.
Pure and utter mayhem. I mean, people were tripping over each other on the floor, bags everywhere.
And the other important thing to remember here as these you're hearing people describing what happened is this guy, armed, somehow had gotten into the area beyond the checkpoints. Now, it is understood that he'd killed one TSA employee, but one big question is how did this guy, armed with a weapon, get past the TSA checkpoints and into the area where there are Burger Kings and people with their kids and Starbucks coffees? How did he get in there?
That is my question. It's like, how did the gun get past the initial security to get to the food court?
Yeah,
it's probably the biggest thorn I have.
And it is an important question.
Crying, screaming.
Everybody started flying down the hallway, and they were just jumping over chairs, jumping over people, hiding, and we were kind of trapped at the end of the terminal.
Trapped with nowhere else to escape, some passengers run onto the airport tarmac. Others use anything they can to protect themselves.
Second shots went in, and then I just grabbed luggage, and I started making walls and walls out of luggages. And then I can see that guy as he's walking towards the escalator and he's just pointing down.
After making it hundreds of feet into the terminal, the gunman is shot by police multiple times in the chest and lives.
Los Angeles Airport Police responded immediately to the calls. They tracked the individual through the airport and engaged him in gunfire in Terminal 3 and were able to successfully take him into custody.
His motive is still unclear, but what is known is the gunman intended to cause much more destruction. Sources say he had 3 magazines of ammunition for his assault rifle.
Now, what's really interesting is as we get into this, as pundits were beginning to analyze what was going on, the assertions early on of NWO conspiracies began to come out.
Do you know anything at this point what officials are saying about this?
Well, some information is now emerging. Our justice reporter, Evan Perez, has spoken to federal law enforcement official who says materials found on the shooting suspect did include a rant that appeared to reference that New World Order, as well as anti-TSA, anti-government claims. It's not clear what really gave rise to these references. Federal investigators have found no known links to any groups or anything in the suspect's background to explain them. For people perhaps not familiar, New World Order is generally accepted to be a conspiracy theory where...
I love how they had to explain it.
It's important. I know. When I hear that, I assume that 80% of America is already quite familiar with what NWO stands for.
Well, if they aren't,
you will be.
Mm-hmm. Well, they weren't the only ones. This is a clip from CBS News right here saying pretty much the same thing. NWO conspiracies.
So why did this happen? Our senior correspondent John Miller is with us. He's the former head of counterterrorism for the LAPD. John, what have you learned about the suspect?
He is Paul Anthony Ciancia. As Carter said, he's from New Jersey. But a lot doesn't emerge. What you don't see is a thick criminal record. You don't see other violent acts. What you don't see is references to him in the FBI files. Yet what you do see today, according to investigators, is he walks into the terminal. He's got the gun in a garment bag. He takes the rifle out. He opens fire, shoots his way through the checkpoint, going down a side, coming around the back. And he's focused on the TSA agents. Inside the bag, we are told investigators came up with notes saying that the TSA were fascists and pigs, anti-American rantings, anti-TSA rantings, and references to the New World Order.
I will say this, by the way. I agree that there is... a borderline fascist element with the TSA, based on my own personal experiences, having been searched many times. After the searches, the TSA people are always very polite. They're firm, but they're polite. They've never been impolite to me, especially the ladies who I've dealt with. And there have been times where, of course, traveling all around the country, carrying radio equipment with me everywhere I go, they typically will say, hey, this is okay. No, it's no problem. I mean, they recognize that I'm friendly. I'm never rude to somebody. And I always, when they're saying, we need to search your bags, I always stay very, very plainly. I always state, you are welcome to search anything. And if you have any questions, just let me know. As a matter of fact, we can go through it together, and I'll stand 4 feet away and tell you what you're touching. And a few of them, the ladies typically are more receptive. There have been a few gentlemen who have not been impolite, but who've been a little bit more cautious. They've gone over all, they've wiped down everything, with their little wipes and all that stuff. I understand they have to do that, but by the same token, it sucks that we live in a world where we have to go through what are random screenings, random pat downs. And yes, the last time I traveled, I flew alone. I was, it was flying up to Paradigm Symposium, all the way there and all the way back, without incident. People were incredibly kind, never had an issue. But when I went out to speak at the UFO Congress, and I was carrying a copy of Christopher Hitchens, the late Christopher Hitchens, Why Orwell Matters. Every airport I went to, it's like I was public enemy number one. So, I kind of understand. The difference between me and estranged psychopaths, people who would go out there and take a gun and shoot human beings to prove a point, the difference between me and those individuals, aside from the fact that I'm not crazy as far as I know, is the fact that the TSA, while I disagree with their policies, have never enraged me to the point that I would take a gun and shoot another human being. But then again, most sane individuals wouldn't do that, right?
Which is kind of a growing conspiracy group that believes the world is going to be taken over by forces in black helicopters and so on. Interestingly, Scott, today he texted his parents from L.A.
This is the shooter.
New Jersey, and said he was going to kill himself today. They called the police. There was a response to his house. Apparently, they didn't make contact with him, but a roommate who didn't know where he was. So this was something that was roiling in his head today.
John, thank you.
In a strange way, though, Tyler, when you hear something like that, okay, this guy texted his parents, he told him what he planned to do. If we had known in time, we could have thwarted this attack. We could have caught this guy. How better to be able to know where this man is and what he's doing than to be able to triangulate his every movement through entirely to the point of absurdity, intrusive surveillance technologies implemented against all American citizens, not because we want to watch people in their underwear or people sitting there and having cyber sex through Skype with their buddies, you know.
TSA porno scanners.
Yeah, like all the Gray Alien listeners do every night, like Tyler and I do every night. Yeah. Your wife loves that. No, I mean, the point is, again, I can see to an extent why the NSA or people like, you know, people in government, not just the NSA. I want to be careful and delineate, because it's not just the NSA. The FBI has also come under fire for a lot of this, but the NSA have really been kind of the people who have been hit the hardest with this. And I'm not sympathizing with them. I don't agree with the surveillance either. However, when you hear stories like this, you can kind of see why and how they would go about justifying their surveillance. And yes, it's not about, you know, I tell you, it's going to be really, really, really boring watching me sitting there writing news stories, writing articles, you know, drinking a beer every night. I'm probably the most boring person in the world. I get it. They're not trying to watch everybody. And they have no intention of doing that. And frankly, they're probably going to be bored if they do it. So
what are you talking about? They're not watching everyone.
They are watching everybody, but no, the NSA and intelligence agencies.
Of course they are.
They're watching. They are gathering data, but I don't think that they're sitting there wanting to watch me. I don't think there's a guy room.
They want to sell you is what it is.
They want to sell video of me sitting there writing articles at 8 o'clock in the evening on a Thursday night.
What they want is, while you're writing articles, to pop an ad up that says, make writing easier.
Oh, interesting.
Subscribe to Grammarly.
Interesting. So you're trying to make a connection between the surveillance programs and the marketization of cookies and ads and tracking and everything that Amazon and all the
big
other different
data.
Online.
I mean, look who's fixing the ACA website, Google.
Look who's fixing
this. This really is the beginnings of like a fascist maneuver.
Hold on. What you are describing, my friend, is a corporatist element. It is a corporatist which government
works. That's what we've had since the end of World War II.
Essentially, yeah, but see, that's the whole thing, is that, and that's what a lot of people don't understand, including these goofballs in the mainstream media. They want to pick apart the NWO thing, like the gentleman we just heard. They want to talk about the fact that the NWO conspiracy theories involve the belief that there is a fascist contingent within government, and that black helicopters are going to be enslaving people. You know what? The real New World Order, folks, is going to be a lot more subversive than that. It's going to be a lot less apparent at the outset. And what it's going to involve is not the direct enslavement of individuals. It's going to be the control of individuals through marketing, through advertisement, through product placement, through corporatist. It's corporatist institution, okay, a bridging between government and our corporations. It's the Gray Alien Report. Stay with us. We'll be right back. For most of us, chocolate is a guilty pleasure. Come on, admit it. You've got a sweet tooth just like the rest of us. But if I told you that eating chocolate was actually really good for your health and happiness, you'd probably say I was in La La Land. Hey, I wouldn't argue. Here's why. Every batch of the fine handcrafted chocolates at La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate is made from scratch, using organic, fair trade, and 100% natural ingredients. From the first bite, you'll know you're enjoying true quality, and the heart shape isn't the only way you'll feel the love. In fact, every chocolate from La La Land Organics is made by Melody Dawn Germain herself, and according to her own special recipe. You'll be enjoying Ecuadorian heirloom cacao in every bite, along with a selection of wholesome herbs and superfood supplements that not only make La La Land Organics delicious, but really good for your health and happiness. They're all natural, gluten-free, and no dairy, soy, or refined sugars are included, which help them boost your energy, reduce stress, and promote longevity. And as if healthy organic chocolates didn't remove the guilt factor enough, Melody ships all her orders in reusable, food-grade, non-BPA containers designed to eliminate toxic residue and cut down on environmental waste. Be sure and visit Melody's website at www.mdgnewmedia.com. That website again is mdgnewmedia.com. Just click chocolate in the toolbar at the top of the page. You can't miss it. And while you're there, you can see a full list of the ingredients that will be sure to put a smile on your face. And I promise, it's guilt-free. La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate. Why wait? That website again is mdgnewmedia.com.
The Council on Foreign Relations. Professor Carol Quigley is allowed to examine the confidential papers and secret records of this network. Quigley reveals that these men aim to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. In short, they seek total and quiet control of the entire world. And the CFR is their most visible conduit for carrying out that agenda.
What I'm about to say is fact. The secret organizations of the world power elite are no longer secret. They have planned and are now leading us into a one-world communist government.
CNN has even reported that these individuals have put out the policy reports through the Council on Foreign Relations that writes their scholarly white papers to end the United States, to end Canada, and to end Mexico.
I hate to break it to you, but after 2 years of denying it and saying this can't be, it's the only reason that I have found that explains everything that's going on in our country with the border. Our country has been sold out in the name of global profits and votes at the ballot box. This is where the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America, or SPP, comes in. This little agreement, international agreement, cooked up by President Bush, the former president of Mexico, and the Prime Minister of Canada. Their mission is to blur or completely erase the borders between Canada, U.S., and Mexico.
Monero is the proposed new currency for the North American community, which is being developed right now between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico to make a borderless community, much like the EU. And the dollar, Canadian dollar, U.S. dollar, and the Mexican peso replaced by the Monero.
Security and Prosperity Partnership, which critics call nothing more than a North American Union. It means open borders, commerce at all cost, and by the way, without the approval of either American voters or the U.S. Congress.
And very unfortunately, it's going to be like the euro dollar, you mean? Well, that would be long, long term.
Even the economists supporting the so-called globalism, and it's not free trade.
Worse, critics say foreign policy elites are promoting a European-style union, erasing borders between the three countries, and eventually moving to a single North American currency called the Amero.
Be a 4,000-mile network of new toll roads with truck and car lanes, rail lines, pipeline, and utility zones. Its projected cost, $183 billion over 50 years.
Welcome back to the program. It is the Graylian Report, wrapping up this first hour of the show. Before we get to James Swagger, taking a very different approach with things during hour two, but that's kind of what we have learned to expect with the Graylian Report. If there's one thing that you can be sure of with this program, it's going to be a mixed bag. Now, I'll tell you this. Again, as we were kind of going at this subject during the last segment, I like to emphasize the fact that a lot of people think that there's going to be a literal enslavement. The kind of stuff that the conspiracy, the popular conspiracy shows would like to sell you on. Literally. Because there's so much corporate interest involved in all this stuff. And I just have to tell you, by the same token, even the people who are warning you about the New World Order conspiracies are trying to sell you water filters and survival seed banks. Tyler's sitting over there laughing. But, you know, it's true. The thing is everybody has a interest, an economic interest, if you will. And the important thing to remember is that if they really want to control you, they're not going to put you in shackles. They're not going to throw you in a cave. They're not going to feed you Soylent Green. What they're going to do is they're going to dumb you down. They're going to make you stupid. And they're going to use mass media and all the things that shouldn't matter, but that you are force-fed daily through media, through the mainstream media. They're going to use those things. Those are going to be the tools, the implements of destruction, in the sense that there's not going to be an overreaching takeover. There's not going to be a situation where you are going to be controlled and enslaved and forced physically. You're going to be led. You're going to be led like the blind sheep to the slaughter, and they're going to do it economically. Now, I'm sure that there are going to be people who are saying, I'm just as sensationalist by putting it to you in these terms. But frankly, I think that that's a closer variation of the truth than the supposed truth that a lot of the fearmongers give you. You will continue to live happily and comfortably and on into your sunset years. May you live a long and happy, peaceful and prosperous life. And for some people, that's okay. I mean, to an extent, I'm okay with that too, but with full knowing that behind the scenes, the strings that are being pulled on the great marionette controlling all things overhead. Those strings are pulling. Those gears are turning in the inner workings, in the underpinnings. And what's being manipulated? The gears that are being turned, the strings being pulled, control the economy globally. And this is what the New World Order, if there is such a thing, this is what it would be about. It would be economic control, not enslaving people, not black helicopters. I mean, you never know. Some of that could come into fruition, depending on the militarization or the necessity thereof that is implemented on down the road as a result of things yet to come. We just don't know where things could go. But as we've seen since the last World War, there's been a trend away toward silent wars, or rather away from global conflicts and toward silent wars. And if there is a necessity for that, the simple reason for it is because, again, people can profit from militarized activities. We've seen this for years, but we haven't seen a world war. And the reason why is because there are simple, quiet operations that can be carried out virtually in secret and unbeknownst to the American public. Alternative media has helped to keep people abreast of these things, and people are more aware, maybe than in previous years, that things like this are going on. But again, the kind of NWO, the New World Order that people want to feed you, maybe isn't the one that exists. And yet, by the same token, I don't think we can deny that there is such a thing. You remember this clip, Tyler? We played this on the program in the past. Joe Biden, Vice President of the United States, literally uses that very term. We played this on Middle Theory earlier today. He's talking about a New World Order. How do I know? Because he says it.
The affirmative task we have now is to actually create a new world order.
He eventually gets around to saying it. He's not the only politician who's ever said that. Famously, on many occasions, George Herbert Walker Bush had also employed this term, NWO, New World Order, in his speeches in reference to a different system of, well, essentially what was described was a global government under the United Nations, a government that would institute a new kind of law and that would institute a new kind of world from anything we had known previously.
A new world order can emerge, a new era, freer from the threat of terror, stronger in the pursuit of justice, and more secure in the quest for peace. An era in which the nations of the world, east and west, north and south, can prosper and live in harmony. 100 generations have searched for this elusive path to peace, while 1,000 wars raged across the span of human endeavor. And today that new world is struggling to be born. A world quite different from the one we've known. A world where the rule of law supplants the rule of the jungle. A world in which nations recognize the shared responsibility for freedom and justice.
We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order, a world where the rule of law, not the law of the jungle, governs the conduct of nations. When we are successful, and we will be, we have a real chance at this new world order, an order in which a credible United Nations can use its peacekeeping role to fulfill the promise and vision of the UN's founders.
What is at stake is a big idea, a new world order, where diverse nations are drawn together in common cause to achieve the universal aspirations of mankind. Now we can see a new world coming into view, a world in which there is the very real prospect of a new world order. In the words of Winston Churchill, a world order in which the principles of justice and fair play protect the weak against the strong. A world where the United Nations, freed from Cold War stalemate, is poised to fulfill the historic vision of its founders.
The historic vision of its founders, and yet again, this is just an audio montage of George Herbert Walker Bush talking. He employs that term. People in the chat room, of course, have pointed out that this is an old term. I again argue that the question here is, a lot of people would like to apply this term to the control, the enslavement of humankind under a fascist, totalitarian, global elite government. I would say that the real evil is always going to be a lot more insidious, a lot more subversive. They're not going to be overt about what they do. They don't care if you know their name, their face, because that's not what true power is. What true power is being able to lurk around the edges and yet have complete and utter control. That is the real New World Order. And I'll tell you this, elements of that may not necessarily be dangerous or even bad, but it is the reality that we have to deal with in the modern era. I'm just not comfortable with it. Maybe the listeners of this program feel the same, but regardless, we'll have to pick that up another time, because when we come back from this break, we'll be joined by James Swagger discussing Sawan and other things here on the Graylian Report. Imagine a place, beautiful, green, sloping mountains, and a rich, mysterious window into our ancient past. It's a culture the likes of which you won't find anyplace else. And while the place I'm describing is in Vermont, it's also the home of Inner Traditions, publishers of fine books on mind, body, and spirit for more than three decades. Inner Traditions are internationally recognized publishers of everything from occult to esoteric and spiritual books, as well as the leading authorities on alternative health, holistic healing, sacred sexuality, altered states of consciousness, and so much more. And frankly, it's not the kind of information you'll find just anywhere. Exploring the inner secrets of humanity requires thinking outside the box. And when it comes to Inner Traditions, the name says it all. All you have to do to learn more is visit innertraditions.com, and you can receive a free catalog that will tell you all about their latest books and newest authors. That's Inner Traditions and Bear & Company, publishers of fine esoteric books for more than three decades. Find them online at innertraditions.com.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
Broadcasting live from the spy capital of the Southeast, it is the Graylian Report, and I'm your host, Micah Hanks, the mouth of the South. And we're about to jump across the big pond and visit with a friend in Ireland, none other than Mr. James Swagger. He's a wonderful guy. I really hope to be able to go and visit him sometime. And he's the author of a fantastic book we'll be talking about, as well as a bit of the history of that annual event known as, well, back in the ancient times, it was known as Samhain, an ancient Celtic festival held every year on All Hallows' Eve that celebrated the end of the fall harvest and, of course, the coming of winter. It was on this night that believers would allegedly beckon the restless spirits from darkness with bonfires and, of course, the sweet offerings from the bountiful harvest. Enough so that Guinness, the purveyors of fine Irish stouts, decided to create a roasted barley-flavored Irish malt. It's very similar to their typical Guinness. It's not a very characteristic thing for me to be drinking Guinness on the air, but this is a special evening here on the Graylian Report. And I will remind the listeners as well that Guinness has a very extremely low alcohol content, and so unless you drink several of these things, you're going to be okay. But that said, it's interesting because this is kind of a tradition. And the very ritual act, I would even call it, of incorporating a brewing process and a beverage and the act of storytelling and sharing culture. All of these things are archetypal in the broader sense of things. And so I felt it was very appropriate to incorporate this into tonight's broadcast because we will be interviewing James Swagger, who is also a radio host. In fact, I've been on his program. But he's also an author. He's the author of a book called The New Grange Serious Mystery, Linking Passage Grave Cosmology with Dogon Symbology. And as I discussed already, we'll also be talking a bit about Samhain, that ancient Celtic festival, which we didn't catch for Halloween, but we've got him with us tonight to discuss it nonetheless. Mr. James Swagger, your first time on the Grailian Report. Welcome, my friend.
Thank you, Micah. It's been a pleasure to be here. It really is.
You know, you're a busy guy because I know last week we were doing our Halloween broadcast and you wouldn't have been able to join us then because you had a program that conflicted. And tonight you had a radio interview before this one, in addition to hosting your own program. You're one of those busy guys like me, huh?
Yeah, I think we have a parallel in terms of what we do, Micah. We're both authors. We both do radio. And, you know, we're just like coming at this from a twofold approach, two sides of the same coin type of thing. And Micah, would probably just agree with this, that, you know, you get this unique perspective being an author, being the interviewer and the interviewee. And you know, I think the information comes to you easier sometimes, you know. And I like to research all sorts, but like you quite rightly said, I'm here to talk about the New Grange Serious Mystery, but I research a lot of stuff on the show and the radio show that I do, my own podcast, Capricorn Radio. I guess I get more freedom to look at different wider spectrum of stuff that I'm not necessarily going to get into and write about, but like I like to get in and research. So it keeps my arms open and the information coming to me, Micah.
We get to see the best of not just both, we get to see the best of all worlds when we are authors, radio hosts, and the actual people who are being interviewed. And so tonight you have the ability to sit back and just answer questions. I know how it can be being an interviewer. You have to really be on the edge of your seat and really know your stuff. Now, we're going to be talking about the New Grange Serious Mystery, your book. But before we get to that, I do want to talk with you for a minute, James, about the ancient Celtic festival of Samhain. You know, we are actually, my producer and I, sharing a Guinness here in the studio tonight in celebration of this. We had a wonderful Halloween broadcast, but that concept goes back much further. Let's take it back to the source, and I'm going to turn it over to you.
Yeah, sure. You know, the reason I couldn't do the Halloween show because somebody already nabbed me. I had Catherine Bookaloo from Truth Connections, and Catherine's show was called The Origins of Spooky. And it's a good show because we did it on Halloween. But for me, the real Halloween, the real what we call Samhain, because for the Irish Gaelic, Samhain is Halloween. It's not really the 31st of October. That's what it is today. But the real Samhain is today, Micah, the 5th of November.
Isn't that great?
This is the real Samhain, i.e. the real Halloween. But like I did on that Halloween show that you couldn't get me for, which was a shame because, it was a different show. And I got into the origins of Halloween and the etymology and basically... And thank you for the pronunciation, Mickey. You were spot on with Samhain. Depends which Gaelic kingdom you're speaking in.
Well, now I have to interject, though. I'm only pronouncing it correctly because previously, when you and I have talked about this, you know,
you wrote it down, didn't you?
You got me trained, so I've got this down now.
Sure. It's funny because your good friend Scotty Roberts, he writes Gaelic at the end of every email, and I was like, you know, he's from I'm sure he would have the spelling right as well. But I mean it's the MH. It looks like Samhain or Samhain, like most people in America pronounce it, because they don't have the pronunciation rule. Take the MH and put a W in and it's all back together again. So that's the pronunciation rule. But in Gaelic, Samhain basically refers to this festival, this Samhain festival. And when you say in Gaelic, Iha Samhain, it basically means, translated as the night in November. And the main night in November is the 1st of November. And actually, Samhain is the Irish Gaelic for our month, actually means November to us. That's what it actually is. So you translate Iha Samhain. So it is a festival as well as the name for the month of November. But the Celts had this festival called Samhain. And like I did on Cathy's show, I really went to town. We're going to talk a bit more about the real Samhain, but just briefly on the Celts and their festival. I mean, they believe that the veil between this world and the other world, nether world, the spirit world, was at its thinnest at this time of year. Now, I think it goes much further than that. The Celts inherited their knowledge from the megalithic builders, which is what I'm here to talk about today, Vicky. So, I mean, I'm going to go back to the real Samhain and the megalithic builders, but just briefly on the Celts, I mean, they were a mixed bunch of people. So to refer to them as one large group that was a civilization is kind of wrong. They were very much tribal, and there was all sorts of pagans in those groups, and there's all sorts of pagans out there today. There's neo-pagans, there's Wiccans, there's Irish pagans, English pagans, Scottish pagans. I mean, each one is their own group within a group within a group. Like, so it's incredibly difficult to typecast these guys. But basically, Samhain, we kind of have some references in the Irish Gaelic that Samhain might have actually been an actual spirit or a person. And what we know is that there's a group of people called the Ishi. Ishi means the people of the mounds, basically. And Ishi were just, when you read what they wrote about these people, the Ishi, which is a Gaelic derivative of a spelling for basically people of the mounds. But and what we think of the mounds is actually the megalithic mounds that we're going to talk about. But the Ishi were described as being incredibly beautiful or incredibly ugly, one or the other, nothing in between. They were talked about them like science fiction, almost like they could go between this world and the other world, like, you know, they were like interdimensional, like the historical tales of the Celts, like, and their what they call mythology reads like science fiction. It's like science fiction in 1000 BC, like, you know, because this is when they originated. But what most people talk about the Samhain festival, they talk about, you know, sacrifice, human sacrifice, animal sacrifice, which may have occurred at parts of Celtic tribes or kingdoms or pagans, like, but not necessarily across the whole. But the original concept was to do with, basically, it was a time of year, the 5th of November in Ireland now. What happens is the 31st of October to about the 5th now. There's a major change happens. There's a really cold snap that comes. It's a time of year where it's not of any particular use to farmers, crops. That's all kind of been done with now. But for slaughtering animals and getting prepared for the winter, that would have happened. And that's probably where the animal sacrifice came in, that they tied it in with around the dating of this festival. So there's a mixed accounts, and each one has some sort of validity. It's a bit murky, like, you know, but basically the where the religious element comes in is that they had a day called All Saints Day, which is the 1st of November now. It wasn't originally that. There is records of it being in April and other dates. We know that from 7th century script. So around the 7th and 9th century, a lot of the written inscriptions that relate to Samhain and the Celts. Now, the Celts spoke Irish Gaelic, but they inherited it from another group, or they a mix of groups, the Celtic tribes. And each Gaelic kingdom, like Scots Gaelic, is slightly different to Irish Gaelic, slightly different to Manx Gaelic. Then you have Welsh Gaelic and Cornish Gaelic being very similar. So each one still has their own different type of celebration around the same time. But whether it was on the 1st of November originally, I don't think so. I think it was around that week of the festival. And the Celts inherited this 5th of November date, which, by the way, is still celebrated with bonfires in England as Guy Fawkes Day today, right, which is even more confusing. So they still celebrate the 5th of November, but it's done for some other cultural reason, but the same date with the same idea of a bonfire.
Interesting. Interesting.
The whole thing is just mixed, Micah. There's a whole mix of stuff in there, and it's very hard to sift through what's real and what's not. But here's the thing. One key monument that I've researched in my work is... just finish on the religious element. That, yeah, I mean, it probably wasn't a bad thing that they tried to stamp out Celtic pagan beliefs at the time because of, like, the sacrificing that was going on. I think the original concept of what Samhain was so delineated into chaos, like, that I think there was all sorts going on, and everybody just decided to just do their own Samhain, like, basically. But, I mean, we're talking about the 9th century. They moved All Saints Day to the 1st of November. And the day before All Saints, Hallow being the Saints, so Hallow's Eve, the day of Hallow's Day was basically the day of the Saints, All Saints, and Hallow's Eve then was the 31st of October. So Christianized paganism, and a lot of the paganism was Christianized. I mean, they put a lot of megalithic sites, they put crosses there, they took a lot of what the Celts did and brought them into the churches, and you know, you even have standing stones and stuff incorporated into churches in Ireland as well.
But, oh, sure. Absolutely.
But the key thing is that All Saints Day, 1st of November, it was fixed at that date to kind of, because that's what the Celts kind of settled around. But I mean, the Celts maybe just had this like week festival and they kind of popularized around All Saints Day. So to think that it's the 31st of October and the 1st of November and then the 5th of November, originally the 5th of November is the real Samhain. Now, let's get into the megalithic stuff, Megan, because
this
is where,
yeah,
this is where it ties in, because I mean, this 5th of what Samhain is actually a special day. And why they say it's the when the veil's at its thinnest, because we're going into wintertime, into darkness. And on the solar wheel, what we call the solar wheel, you have spring, autumn, winter, and summer. We have the spring and autumn equinox, and we have the winter and summer solstice. And that's basically a cross within a circle. So you can picture four segments of a circle. Now, that's not very revealing. Okay, so what you do is you further split that into halves again. So the halfway between equinox and solstice, you have these halfway points, and that's what Samhain is basically is. Samhain is just one of these special days, and it exactly occurs on the 5th of November astronomically, not culturally, astronomically. This 5th of November is the real Samhain. Now, this pagan wheel still survives, and all the other halfway dates are known as Lunisa. Basically, that's our month for August as well. We that's our name for August, which is, but it's still the same name for the pagan day of the halfway point. That's the 3rd of August. That's when it's a halfway between summer solstice and autumn equinox. Then you have Imbolc, which is the February 1, the 3rd or 4th of February. And then you also have Beltane. Now, Beltane is probably the next famous one. Some people say Beltane in America because of the pronunciation, or Beltane, Beltane, Beltane. And they still celebrate that in Scotland. It was actually the opposite of Halloween. And still today in Scotland, they will have, it's Christianized into May Day now, or popularized as May Day. Mm. But it actually occurs on the 3rd of May. Same thing again. Put it on the 1st of the month because it's nearly the 1st of the month. Everybody remembers the 1st of the month. Nobody's going to remember whether it's the 3rd or 4th. They're oversimplifying things again. But basically, Beltane, same thing. They have these ancient monuments linked up with days of these cross-quarter days. So we have monuments lined to Beltane. And they burn bonfires on Beltane as well. Especially still today in Scotland, up in the Shetlands, they have Beltane festivals. So. But the key thing is, the New Grain Serious Mystery, it's a book about ancient cosmology. I delve into all the monuments, Micah, and I've compiled my best approach to the cosmology of ancient Ireland. And basically, I took some theories that were there, some theories that needed tweaking, and some were my own, and I compiled them all in because nobody was talking about the cosmology. There was haphazard approaches to this. Everybody was running to New Grange trying to crack the megalithic civilization, for what I could see, and they would forget about the other ones or else mention the other ones in passing. And there wasn't a good compilation. But in my compiling of that book, The New Grange Serious Mystery, this Samhain alignment comes up at Loch Crewe. And basically, Loch Crewe is a megalithic cemetery complex. They say cemetery complex because these ancient megalithic mounds were burial chambers.
They were
also astronomical observatories, and they were also sound chambers that myself and Gary Evans were in testing, our good friend Gary Evans as well. Now, the thing is, they're very complex monuments. They've got art all around the mounds. They have sophisticated sound. I've had some musicians inside testing the acoustics as well, drumming, guitar, and chanting. And the key thing is, they're sophisticated sound chambers. They're have beams of sunlight that come in on special days of the year. Newgrange, the winter solstice, sunrise for 17 minutes once a year. That's it. You know, this monument was built for a 17-minute event once a year.
It seems to have had a very specific source. Now, listen, James, we're going to have to hold off for just a moment because we got to go pay the bills. You know, you mentioned, however, music in conjunction with all this, you know, I've got to come over there and visit sometime, because being a musician myself, I would love to be in one of these sound chambers and experience this first time. We're talking with James Swagger. He is the author of the book, The New Grange: Serious Mystery, Linking Passage Grave Cosmology with Dogon Symbology, and how this all ties in with the famous discussion of Samhain, an ancient Greek Celtic festival. I'm Micah Hanks. It's the Graylian Report. Stay with us. We'll be back right after this. Busy summer, huh? And it's only going to get busier. Thanksgiving's already right around the corner, and before you know it, we'll all be singing Jingle Bells. Don't you deserve a break? Well, this year, why not make it a winter vacation and join the Ancient Alien Cruise as it sets sail from Fort Lauderdale on January 9th, 2014. Kick things off with a private cocktail reception, followed by lectures by some of the finest researchers in the field. Author and publisher David Hatcher Childress will be there, as well as Megalithomania's Hugh Newman, geologist and author Robert Schock, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, host of the Micah Hanks program on KGRA Radio. But you don't just have to sit and listen. This cruise will present a one-of-a-kind opportunity to meet your hosts, discuss mysteries of the ancient past, dine with the speakers aboard one of the ship's fine restaurants, and even engage in land excursions to ancient sites. Broaden your horizons while taking a little time off and enjoy watching the sunset over the high seas. Visit AncientAlienCruise.com or call 1-877-642-4308 and reserve your cabin today before time runs out. Visit AncientAlienCruise.com. As the amber of autumn sets over the November horizon, we continue our discussion with James Swagger. He's the author of a book called The New Grange: Serious Mystery, which we've just begun to get into with him on the heels of our discussion about the Samhain celebration of the ancient Celtic rite. It's a fascinating discussion. You know, Tyler and I, during the break, before we get back with James, I do have to say, we were talking about how interesting it is that all of these elements would align on a day like this. Here we have a U.S. election taking place. It's not a significant election in terms of being presidential or anything like that.
Are any significant?
Any more, they may not be, Tyler. But there is a significance to the fact that it's an election day. And then we also have the alignment of Guy Fawkes Day of V for Vendetta fame with the discussion of the Samhain celebration. It's interesting that so much aligns. Energetically, there seems to be a lot going on here. James, it is a singular day in that sense, that so much seems to converge on early November. Do you have any feeling as to why?
Funny you say this, Micah. Wasn't there something happening in Washington today as well, some energetic event?
Oh,
they had a massive march in Washington, D.C.
That was the anonymous, the Million Mask March, I believe, right?
Well, actually, I did actually ask the question to the person who told me, who owns the mask manufacturing company? I think
there
might
question.
Be a conspiracy behind that. But yeah, you always seem to get things, and it's not just like Samhain. Like I say, these key days of Imbolc, Beltane, Lunasa, and so on, these cross-quarter days, as they're called, seems to be always a day of energetic. Yeah, it's well picked up on that point, Micah. Seems to be people seem to do things that pick these days for events or energetic or... Yeah, it's bizarre, like, you know, definitely. I think there's a time of reflection, and I think that's what the Samhain festival was, that they used to reflect on I mean, they would say that, you know, that they would reflect on their dead ancestors and they would leave, they would set food out for their ancestors. And like, you know, they believe that's when they came to visit, because that's when the veil was thinnest. Like, you know, it was a time for reflection, time for energy, and a time to be aware of it. Yeah, like I say, it is actually on the 5th of November. Loch Crew Cairn El. Cairn is a heap of stones in Irish Gaelic, and right. On a hill usually. And Cairn El, they're not illustrious. Some of them don't have very illustrious names. They're like alphabetic names, like A, B, C, D. And some have very nice names, like Newgrange and Gavrinus and Queen Maeve's Cairn and stuff like that. But some have just alphabets. But Cairn El is the one we're talking about. It's the Samhain Monument, basically. And what happens, actually, is a beam of sunlight comes in. I was there yesterday to witness it. And I didn't, what, the sun wasn't there. It was on the horizon. I could see it lining up, but I didn't see the event. But anyway, it was the only time I've tried to see it. Like, and, but the
James,
key thing
by the way, is that the one on the cover of your book by chance?
No, that's the one on the cover of the book is the Newgrange Monument.
Oh, okay.
The Samhain Monument that I'm talking about, I can send you a picture, but it's basically got like a V-shaped passageway coming into it, and inside it usually is a standing stone. It's like a limestone pillar about 6 foot tall, standing stone. Some of the best acoustics in there too. And also it looks like there's a picture of a solar eclipse, if you can imagine that. But it actually is carbonated to about the same time as what we can astronomically date that there was a solar eclipse at Loch Crew in 3500 BC when this event took place, like in around Samhain. So there was I think the Samhain alignment is the 5th of November, and the solar eclipse happened around the November month as well. So it's probably why the solar eclipse rock art is in there. I talk about that in the book. But yeah, you know, we're looking at these guys, not just mapping Samhain, but like it's a great way to talk about the book today, because the cross quarter days were equally as important as the solstices.
Now let's get into that book, but I do want to just assert here also, as if it had to be said, just this week we also had that massive solar eclipse visible from three different continents. Yeah.
I know people on the East Coast couldn't be bothered getting up for it. And I'm like, what is wrong with you people? I would love to see a solar eclipse. It's very rare we would get them in Ireland. I think the closest we ever had was, you know, a partial eclipse like around the year 2000, I think. But I mean, that was wonderful to get that East Coast, like, you know. But I know loads of people just couldn't stay up for it. And I'm a night owl anyway. I wouldn't have slept for a day waiting on that one. But
tell folks at home, by the way, what time it is Irish time right now, you are.
It's 2:30 a.m. and I'm pumped, man. I'm about to break out river dance at this stage.
Staying up late just to be on the Graylian. Thank you so much, James.
Not really. I am terrible, Mickey. I get out of bed like at about 6 p.m. I am actually on American time. I talk to more people in America than I do in Ireland. But like, I mean, yeah, I go to bed during the late afternoon. I only sleep about 4 hours a day, and I go to bed about 2 p.m. and I get up about 6. Like, that's usually my day, like, you know.
I'm very much like you, except for the fact that I stay up really late and I get up really early, which is the very reason why I get so little sleep. But no, maybe that is kind of how you are. So I take it, writing a book, then you probably were keeping some strange hours doing that just as well. So,
you know. Yeah, you know, and that's the thing. I mean, I usually go into writing mode and then I go into radio mode and then I'm going back into, you know, research mode, and I do what I want when I want, basically. I have a great life, Mickey, but it's not very lucrative. I wish it was more lucrative, but I in terms of achieving what I want to do and exploring my brain, my intellect, and getting my information out there. I mean, I eat when I'm hungry and I sleep when I'm tired, and I do all my research, everything in between. And it's stuff I like to research, Mickey. It's not like work to me. Yes, there's labor involved and they do long hours, and it kind of gets a bit, you know, mind-bending at times, but like, you know, it's a wonderful life in terms of I'm doing what I want to do, Mickey, you know, because I'm bringing a story about the megaliths to the table that isn't very well told, Mickey. It's really not, like, and I discovered some rock art. Let me just mention Ardmore rock art before I go into, like, other monuments. Like, I mean, Ardmore rock art wasn't even documented, Mickey. It's like a few miles from my house here. And when I found out about it from an article in a magazine, an old article, I went to check it out, and I just seen constellations on the standing stone, with which was about, you know, 6 foot six above the ground. So therefore, it had to be 6 foot six into the ground. You couldn't get your arms around this thing. It's quite chunky. It's probably about 4 foot wide by 4 foot wide, like a, in a chunk, like a square. So it's quite a large standing stone. And it's got Ursa Major and Ursa Minor on it, on the right-hand side, on the left-hand side. Even at that, this brightest star of Ursa Major is denominated with concentric circles as well, unusually, which I didn't write about in the book, and I only noticed afterwards. But the key thing was, it was Ursa Major, Ursa Minor, two of the most important constellations for navigating the seas. All ships use it. I mean, it's how we find the North Star, and therefore the North Pole, and therefore the our direction in this northern hemisphere. However, it wasn't documented. The only reference I could find of it was, you know, a misconception of what it actually was drawn. I mean, he called it a decipherment, but it was misdrawn. It was distorted. He tried to make it into something else. I don't need to put down the other author other than, you know, it's in the book, and I didn't see it documented very properly. But he didn't even call it Ursa Major, Ursa Minor, like, you know, he called it some other constellation. But, you know, it's in the book, and it's there, and it's documented now. But that's kind of why I got into it, Mickey. You know, it's kind of, I seen something that was like, you know, in this 5 years ago now, but I mean, still relatively modern world, you know, it's like the stuff not documented properly. And when I got more into the art and the megaliths, and the reason, let me just say this, Mickey, the reason I concentrated on Ireland mostly in the book is not because I'm Irish. It's because Ireland has 45% of the rock art of all of the whole of Europe sitting in a 2 mile radius. The whole of Europe, the rock art of the whole of Europe, half of it is almost in a 2 mile radius. Like,
wow.
And yeah, so that'll just tell you how much rock art is here. Now, if you have rock art, you have a story, you have something to interpret. If you don't have the rock art, it's very hard to know what was going on.
Well, I just have to say, yeah, here in Western North Carolina, we have a lot of rock art just as well. Most of it is attributed to the Cherokee, but, you know, again, I'm someone who's always been fascinated with it, and yet we don't have a clear narrative as to what the origins of this rock art is, and so I've always been fascinated by rock art just as well. But as you say, James, it seems to kind of point to, well, kind of an ancient, more than just an ancient cosmology, literally what I think Robert Bovall has referred to as a symbolic astronomy. And actually, he even referred to this in reference to your book as being, it is my own belief that soon we may discover that there was a global prehistoric megalithic culture communicating in the silent language of this so-called symbolic astronomy. So is that what these ancient people were doing? And contrary to modern physics and modern science writers, one that comes to mind, Philip Plait, who wrote for Astronomy Magazine, saying that people don't look up, is it quite the contrary? Did the ancients look up?
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. Robert wrote me a lovely review for the book, and obviously what better man to appreciate my work than the guy who kicked off archaeoastronomy in the modern world. And it was largely because of Robert Bovall that I ended up writing the book, because I wouldn't have researched archaeoastronomy. And yes, you're quite right in say, I mean, the ancients used a thing called observational cosmology, which is basically, you know, using the naked eye to watch and record the heavens, you know, no telescopes, basically monitor the solstices. And let's tie this in visual terms just before the break, if I can.
Sure.
I won't go too mad, but basically, if you watch the sunrise and the sunset, you'll see it rise in the east and set in the west. Then if you watch it over the year, you will say, oh, it's got, in this part of the world, this latitude, in the winter, it rises in the southeast and it sets in the southwest. Now, in the summertime, summer solstice, it rises in the northeast and sets in the northwest. So you'll get extreme points where the sun rises and the sun sets, but it doesn't go any further than that. So they're extreme standstill points, if you want to. Now, if you mapped out, think about this, Mick, map out a row of standing stones to map these solstices. Yeah, that's no brainer. That's easy. That's not even like, you know, difficult, you know. So to get the sunbeam to penetrate into these ancient monuments that we're talking about, like Newgrange and Loch Crew for the Samhain, you know, it was all about finding the day. Getting the sunbeam to come in was easy. Like, you know, finding the day of the solstice was easy. Now, this pagan wheel, you know, this these halfway points, that was a difficult one, because The spring and autumn equinox was basically in the middle of the east. So you have the southeast, the southwest, the northeast, the northwest, and the east and west. Like, so you have all these cardinal points laid out. Now, getting the exact halfway point, that was the tricky one. And what we find outside the Selwyn complex, that's aligned today, the 5th of November, we see ones that are slightly... it actually happens at an azimuth, an angle of 110 degrees for discussion purposes. But we see ones that are aligned to 108 degrees or 116 degrees or 112 degrees. And it looks like they were trying to fine-tune the day that this happens. So what we have is an evolution in monuments. So they built all these baby ones trying to target the exact day. And when they got it, they built this big giant monument to it called Loch Crew Carnell, like we call it today. And they captured the sunbeam in there and they made this into... This is what they did. They compiled cosmology by looking over the heavens. Now, it wasn't just the sun, Mickey. Yes, they did this, and I attribute Loch Crew as what I call in the book a solar mapping complex, because it was all about the sun there. They have like a, what I think was a 16-month solar... 16-month solar year, months being about 22, 23, 25 days, like we have 28, 30, 31. They just did it in lower numbers, like 20, 23, 24, something like that. And there's reasons for that, because they have 16 rays coming off a sun, and there's art to back that up, and there's some theories in the book about that. So the thing is, I mean, I found myself having to get into the mindset of these guys, Micah, and really get into their cosmology. And yes, it really was a cosmology, but it was an observational cosmology. Now, that's the sun for daytime, okay? You equally have the same for the moon. Now, if you're going to take on the sun, you're going to naturally do the next moving body in the sky, the moon. And they mapped moon calculations too, Micah. I mean, they had the sidereal lunar month and the synodic lunar month. And I attribute that to Noth, a place called Noth, the Noth Lunar Temple. And I mean, it, for just discussion purposes, one's 27.3 days and one's 29 and a half days. Neither one is right or wrong. They're both, it depends where you use the backdrop of the stars as your reference point, or to get the moon to come back to the same point on the horizon. Like, so it doesn't really matter which, it depends which is your point of reference. Each lunar month is correct. We use the 29 and a half day lunar month because that's the observational one, but there is actually a correct one, which is the sidereal lunar month. Like, one's the real one. Like, but anyway,
are there problems? A quick question, actually. Are there issues in terms of aligning the ancient sites and their astronomical, I guess, what would you call it, alliances, for lack of a better term, with the modern calendar, because of a difference maybe between the calendar being utilized by ancient people who would have erected these ancient monolithic sites, or megalithic sites actually, or both, versus the modern calendar year and how these things are supposed to align themselves?
Well, yeah, okay. So for the sun alignments, the ones that they're most famous for, I mean, by the way, most archaeologists barely accept that. They accept Newgrange because it comes in every day and it's every year at the winter solstice, and it's a spectacle. But basically, the sun comes in on a solstice the same day every year as it did 5,000 years ago. It's the same point on the horizon. It doesn't move because the sun is in our own solar system, obviously.
Yeah. So they've got a pretty good reference point then, don't they?
Yeah. Now, there is a thing called the obliquity of the ecliptic and this wobble in the earth. Now, that will knock it out of alignment, but very, very, very slight, Micah. I mean, it's not hitting the exact center of the chamber, and you can actually work it back and it fits in beautiful with the carbon dating. But the point is, yeah, I mean, the sun, no. The moon, again, it's a moving body going around the earth, so no, that doesn't affect. Now, when you're looking at the stars, and like I say, the observational cosmology wasn't just the sun and the moon. They were looking up, watching the heavens. Now, they tracked constellations. Now, it affects the constellations. This is the key thing. So, and Graham Hancock and Robert Bavall would be famous for bringing precession of the equinoxes into modern concepts and what it means. But basically, the stars do look different in 5,000 years, Micah. I mean, they actually shift in practical terms 1 degree every 72 years, which is a modern lifetime. That's why we kind of quote that, and people can understand that a lot easier. So basically, the moon is about 3 degrees. So after 200 years, I say, it would have shifted the width of the moon, basically, on the horizon. So if you were looking at a constellation like the Pleiades, like they did, or Ursa Major, like they did, or Orion, or the star of Sirius, and they were tracking it, and 200 years later, it wouldn't be aligned anymore. So if you're building any calendars on constellations, that wouldn't work very well. But they seem to have had a lunar month, and they seem to have had the solar month pretty mapped out. So that's why you would use the sun and the moon for calendars. Stars would be no good.
Interesting.
But it looks now, here's the thing now. Imagine you have a row of standing stones, which they're all over the Megalithic Empire. Now, if you put a row of standing stones and you align to the star Sirius or constellation Pleiades or whatever, I mean, a certain amount of years later, it's not going to be aligned anymore. And you're going to know that, Micah. You're going to know that constellation isn't where it's supposed to be. And that's accommodating for because the constellations change over winter and summer. So these guys are watching long periods of time, and they're watching throughout the year. Now, the thing about that is, I mean, they would have known that, and they would have had to really scratch their heads. But this is what they were in the business of, Micah. They were in the business of figuring things out. So this would have been the golden prize. The Greeks wrote about this, the great year. You know, it was known in ancient times. Like, how far back into ancient times? I think they tried to calculate the rate of precession, which is what I call the Newgrange series mystery. I think Newgrange was a precessional calculator, albeit very, very crude, Micah.
How interesting.
I think they were trying to calculate the rate of precession.
Yeah.
And just the little premise for the book, the triple spiral on the entrance stone, I think, matches up with Sirius because of the Dogon tradition and a whole hullabaloo of facts and data and mythology. It's like, and they use the same symbology and the same ideology to represent the same thing. But the tri-spiral lines up with the star Sirius at the time when Newgrange was built. And then it would have migrated into the chamber exactly 1 degree of precession. It was exactly 1 degree of precession from the center of that triple spiral to the center of the entrance stone. And we know the center of the entrance stone because there's a line marking the center of the entrance stone. So, and I've calculated that. It's a simple trigonometry. It's not advanced mathematics. It's a long elongated triangle. It's easy to measure. I've measured it. I've shown the calculations in the appendix in the back of the book. But just as you mentioned precession, I think that's the key thing to mention here, that this sunbeam, by the way, penetrated, Micah, 60 feet into a mound. So it was quite a feat of engineering just to do that alone. So, but the accuracy of the sunbeam penetrating in 60 feet meant that it was like a 17-minute event once a year. The sun didn't come in or drift in or light the doorway up any other time because the passageway was so long.
Right.
It could only line up on one day of the year. Now, the thing is, this all happens on the winter solstice, the 21st of December. Now, 12 hours later, when the sun goes down from the sunrise event, the Sirius is on the horizon in almost the exact same position as the sun. Almost. Now, what happens is, it hits the center of the tri-spiral. Eventually, precession will keep making Sirius, because Sirius can move because it's outside our solar system. It's processing across the sky. Eventually, it will migrate into the exact same position as the sun and then come inside the chamber and do exactly what the sun does. But then precession will keep moving it, and then it will go out. And this all happens in the window, that 200-year window when Newgrange was in popular activity. Like, not only that, the triple spiral is inside at the center of the back chamber on the right-hand side. And one of the chamber stones. Now, the key thing about that is, my theory is the only one that explains the triple spiral inside and the triple spiral outside.
And what's so interesting too, James, is that when we look at this, we begin to see, unlike what many skeptical theorists would propose, that the ancients, or rather the modern interpretation of the ancients and their activities was that there were aliens coming to Earth and genetically manipulating us. Quite the contrary, they were involved in a very complex cosmological interaction with the world around them. They were looking at the stars, and they were trying to understand essentially what was going on in terms of where we are in the solar system, how we relate to things going on around us in the solar system, you know, how we relate to other celestial bodies. It wasn't just Newgrange. There was Noth, Douth, Carrakeel, Lough Cru, and Fornox. Maybe we'll ask about some of these other sites and the solar mapping theories that relate to each of those when we come back, and maybe even this upcoming book, the next installment that James is working on. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Grayling Report. Stay with us. We'll be back right after this. For most of us, chocolate is a guilty pleasure. Come on, admit it. You've got a sweet tooth just like the rest of us. But if I told you that eating chocolate was actually really good for your health and happiness, you'd probably say I was in La La Land. Hey, I wouldn't argue. Here's why. Every batch of the fine handcrafted chocolates at La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate is made from scratch, using organic, fair trade, and 100% natural ingredients. From the first bite, you'll know you're enjoying true quality, and the heart shape isn't the only way you'll feel the love. In fact, every chocolate from La La Land Organics is made by Melody Dawn Germain herself, and according to her own special recipe. You'll be enjoying Ecuadorian heirloom cacao in every bite, along with a selection of wholesome herbs and superfood supplements that not only make La La Land Organics delicious, but really good for your health and happiness. They're all natural, gluten-free, and no dairy, soy, or refined sugars are included, which help them boost your energy, reduce stress, and promote longevity. And as if healthy organic chocolates didn't remove the guilt factor enough, Melody ships all her orders in reusable, food-grade, non-BPA containers designed to eliminate toxic residue and cut down on environmental waste. Be sure and visit Melody's website at www.mdgnewmedia.com. That website again is mdgnewmedia.com. Just click chocolate in the toolbar at the top of the page. You can't miss it. And while you're there, you can see a full list of the ingredients that will be sure to put a smile on your face. And I promise, it's guilt-free. La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate. Why wait? That website again is mdgnewmedia.com. Wrapping up this week's edition of the program, it is the Greatly Important, and I'm Micah Hanks. We're talking with James Swagger. He's author of the book, The New Grange Serious Mystery. Boy, this discussion has really just covered just about everything, run every gamut in terms of linking ancient cosmology with mound science and even esoteric rituals of the ancients. A fascinating discussion, and as I understand, this discussion will probably continue on into the future, because I believe our guest, Mr. James Swagger, also will have a follow-up book that he's going to be producing in addition to this one. You can learn more about this. As a matter of fact, actually, as opposed to me telling you, I'll just ask James. James, for folks who want to follow your work, where can they find how to buy this book, how to follow your work, and more about what you do?
Oh, thank you, Micah. Yeah, I usually just direct everybody to my main page, my jamesswagger.com. If you just Google James Swagger, you'll find it. Two G's for Swagger. And you'll find my Capricorn Radio page there, my live shows. You'll find my books there. I am doing a web design for every book, a separate web page, but I host them all under jamesswagger.com. And that way I can dress them up differently. I can treat each one as a separate entity. And I don't want to confuse everybody. So, but the book is on New Grange cosmology. So not an original concept, but newgrangecosmology.com is the name of the page. For the book, you can get the copy there. If you get a copy off my webpage, I'll send you a signed copy, obviously. Or feel free to get it on Amazon, Kindle, or PDF if you like. You can buy it on the website there. If I can email you a copy, try and give you as many formats as I can. And I have another book coming out as well. And
Let's talk about that. The next book, because I definitely want to hear about that. I know it has a little to do with music, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, I've had Santos Bonacci with me here, and I've had Gary Evans, the two people a week back to back and separate weeks doing some testing and acoustic. And I wanted to hold off finishing some stuff in the book until I had some musicians testing. I also had a didgeridoo player, my Italian interpreter, her boyfriend. I met him at the Malta Equinox event in an ancient temple there. But so I've had sorts of musicians doing testing, and it was just to bring an experiential element, because I had scientific equipment testing the acoustics at the same said ancient sites that the cosmologies are making. Now, like I say, these are acoustic monuments as well as astronomical observatories. They're very, very complex, Micah. It's people just kind of wrestle with that, as I did. But you can't take away from the evidence. It's there to measure if you want to go and measure it. And, you know, sadly, so, some of the monuments weren't measured, Micah, for acoustics. And that's what I got into. And my sequel is called The Megalith Acoustics Mystery, a quest to understand altered states at ancient temples. And I had read a book called Supernatural by Graham Hancock.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a great book. And I came to a page on entoptic phenomena, which is basically a host of shapes and symbols that you would see when you go on a transcendental state, whether that's there's a multitude of ways to get there. You can use acoustics, you can use psychedelics, you can use rhythmic dance and chanting. And so there's many methods to get there. Many ancient cultures recent cultures, living cultures around the world do this. And the key thing is, when I didn't see entoptic phenomena, I see Newgrange art. Because I'm looking at, I think I've been to Newgrange 100 plus times. I grew up at the foothills of Newgrange. And I'm doing tours 24/7. I did tours for a long time because my father's friend was a coach driver, and he knew I was into the monuments. And, you know, it's best to get somebody who's experienced in them. And I used to do tours, and I hated doing it. It was a burden. I used to get these phone calls at last minute to go and do them. But I made okay money at it. And so I have all this knowledge. But anyway, it's not just I've seen Newgrange once or twice. I've seen it so many times. The art is embedded in my memory. Like, I can't escape it. So when I see an entoptic phenomena, I'm like, oh my God, there's so many of these are entoptic phenomena. Now, they're mystery symbols even to astronomy, because some of the art is known astronomical calculations of moon calculations and constellations, like I talked about in the Newgrange Sirius mystery. I mean, I did a whole book on that, and I kept it just on the astronomy. I wanted to talk about other stuff, and I linked it with the Dogon tribe and their same similar symbology. And I mean, I was also aware of this acoustics knowledge. Now, where this ties in with entoptic phenomena, I mean, I thought acoustics, I thought acoustics was the route that they chose to go into these altered states. And that's what the entoptic phenomena was, the acoustically induced entoptic phenomena. Now, of course, I had read several books, and I was aware when I was doing the astronomy research that of the acoustics element too. And there was a book called Stone Age Soundtracks in 2001 by Paul Devereaux, and I had got into that, and that was pretty much the extent. That and another couple of books talking about acoustics, but there wasn't any great research done. It was very rushed research, the initial research done, and it was sporadic all across the megalithic empire of Britain, Ireland, and other parts. And I've since been all over, like places, Brittany on doing acoustics testing in Scotland, and especially Carol Keel that you mentioned just before the break there. And the key thing is, Micah, I mean, it's not just acoustics. I naively thought it would prove it as acoustics, but I wanted to understand what these altered states. And like you say, these guys were exploring, many things, an altered state of consciousness, basically. They were exploring their consciousness, and they left us art to tell us that they did that. Now, it may be open to interpretation whether it was acoustics or psychedelics. I actually think it was both. I have two separate threads of evidence to link both.
Huh.
And so the thing is, this one's scientific and one's annotations by other authors and ancient cultures, and it's a bit of a long-winded explanation. But I mean, you can go and measure these internal measurements of these chambers, and they're set up acoustically. Like, I mean, I had Gary Evans, and who loves this type of stuff. He's very much into experiential and acoustics research. He spends time in the Great Pyramid chanting and exploring his consciousness, and I was drumming with Gary just quite recently, and I experienced this myself. And I mean, I came out, my mind was like jelly, because I sustained the drumming inside the acoustic chambers that these things are for 5 to 7 times a second. I was trying to keep the pace up. Now, it's quite fast drumming. Like, I mean, 7 is really where you want to be at. 7 times a second, your arm has to be pretty fast. And to do it for several minutes is, I have this on my YouTube channel, by the way, Mickey, you can check it out. But the key thing is, these are theta frequencies. These are the frequencies that affect your brain waves. These are theta frequencies, the alpha, beta, and theta frequencies. Theta frequencies, 5 to 7 hertz. And basically, your brain goes into a transcendental state, but as you're drumming, like, you know. And I came out of the chamber, my mind was like jelly, Micah. I really was. It was like almost like a hypnotic thing, you know. And the thing is, this consciousness art, as we like to call it, this entoptic phenomena, this is where I kind of, it really sparked off for me. And I'm an engineer and a scientist. scientist, Mickin, the efficient engineer in me went, okay, I'm not going to go around the British Isles twice doing this. I'm going to do this once and I'm going to measure the acoustics and I'm going to measure the astronomy. The astronomy is pretty easy. Compass, maps, diagrams, all that type of stuff. Take some photographs and, you know, map it out that way. But the acoustics is a bit difficult. It was battery equipment, frequency generators. I wanted, it's not just the theta frequencies too, Mickin. It's, you know, they all resonate as well. It's the fact of standing waves. Any chamber, Mickey, you put a, pick a box, make a box out of something yourself at home and stand inside it and chant, you'll get a certain sound out of that. Your room that you're in now will have its own acoustics. Like, obviously, we have furniture and doorways that dampen everything and mess it up. But, I mean, we put stuff in for damping, and sometimes we make more hall effects and cathedral type effects. But I mean, any type of geometric design will give its own acoustics. But it looks like they had internally specifically targeted certain geometric designs for the acoustics. Whether they started off to do this initially, Mika, I'm not too sure. But I think they evolved into it.
That seems to be the mystery, is, you know, how much of it was intentional? How much of it did they acquire along the way?
Sure. And the thing is, I mean, I measured the equipment and I brought it all with me, and I sat on the research for 2 years, Mick, until I got the one project out of the way. And I thought it was mad at the time, going around looking at this equipment. I went, not that I was never going to do it, but I was like, you know, I could have just done this 2 years from now. And says, I'm glad I did now, because I did it the right way. I mean, it was a tough doing something that I wasn't going to do straight away. I was like putting an awful lot of extra burden onto something that was already burdensome. But
the tough stuff, though, that's what always pays off in the long run, right?
It was a smart decision in the long run, yeah. But I mean, at that time, I was questioning myself. But
of course,
and the thing is, basically, I would carry up frequency generators, and I would change frequencies and work with tones, and I would see which one resonated more, that you would get the acoustic effect back. And sure enough, they all resonate inside the male vocal range, except for two that resonate in the female vocal range in Carole Keel. But the thing is, I was aware of this, and the Hypogeum is a megalithic complex in Malta, and it's the most sophisticated one in terms of the megalithic temples. It's an underground 3-story cave system, and you can basically speak into this hole called the Oracle Hole, like an om or a chant, and the whole thing resonates. And each room hasn't got a doorway into it, Mick. It has like an aperture, basically like a guitar soundbox. The sound hole on a guitar is basically a hole or an aperture that goes into a bigger room, the box of the guitar, obviously. And when you strike the string, which is set up as a standing wave, which you can change the length of the standing wave, therefore the note of the string, by putting your fingers on fretboards. But that vibrating string resonates inside the sound box, the box of the guitar. And basically, that's what the Hypogeum is. I don't know why people question it. Because they're not acousticians. The people that are in charge of these monuments are archaeologists. And not to pick faults with archaeologists, but the key thing is, each room resonates because it's an aperture, not a doorway going into it. And the aperture opens up into another room, as does the megalithic chambers like Newgrange and Loch Crewe, Carnell, Carntee, Carole Keel. They built recesses off the main central chamber, which was a corbel vault. They're almost like cathedrals on the inside, Mika.
Right.
Even when you draw a sound map, if the sound source was in the center of the central chamber, there would be a recess to the left, a recess to the right, and a recess to the back of the chamber, almost like the shape of a cross. The sound would go out in all directions. Therefore, it would go into the three chambers. It would reflect off the wall and come back out again. And when it met in the center of the chamber again, the sound dissipates into three directions and comes back again and coalesces, and therefore amplifies, and a resonance is set up. It would naturally do this if you just built that design, but there seems to be an evolution in acoustic design, and it seems to be intentional. They even put special sills in. This is the key thing that I looked at, Mick, and I twigged it one day. I went, is this intentional or not? You know, and it really doesn't even matter if it's intentional or not. I mean, because the art is there, tells us that these guys are exploring their consciousness, and they pretty got off on this stuff. Like, they pretty much liked it. But they had floor sills that don't make any other sense. Like, no, there's no engineering reason for them. They're not waterproofing. They're a burden. You have to step over them. But basically, they sealed the passageway acoustically by putting in large steps, basically, that you can step over. So certainly the long passageways, And basically, they're making the passageway into a series of apertures and rooms so that you have to come through them. So, you know, everything about, especially quarantine, you can see this more in quarantine than anywhere. And even into the recesses, you have to step over these little floor sills. And then there's also, you put your head under a head sill as well. So they sealed the rooms off and made them apertures to get in, just like the hypogeum in a way. But the hypogeum is more easy to witness. I mean, the hypogeum just resonates. The whole cave system resonates. And they even put a little box in the wall going, speak in here. This is how you activate the chamber, like, you know. So this is the sophistication of what these guys are doing.
Well, it was highly sophisticated. They obviously knew what they were doing, so much so that we haven't even got the time to be able to continue tonight getting into everything that they could do. And that is a clear indicator of one thing, James, and that is that you've got to come back when this next book comes out. There's so much more we could discuss with regard not just to the Newgrange Sirius mystery, but really I think what should be effectively titled The Audiology of the Ancients. You, sir, would qualify for being a gentleman who could discuss this subject. Once again, for folks who are listening at home, where they can find out about you and your work and your ongoing research.
Well, thank you, Mick. I'd love to come back sometime. It's been a pleasure. It really has. And jamesswagger.com. That'll take you to my author's page. You can catch my podcast there. You can read about my work, my books, and I welcome any emails or feedbacks on the book. You can catch it there. Just follow the links for my books. And I should have the Megalith Acoustics Mystery, the sequel that everybody's waiting for. I've held off on it for a couple of months, Mickey, just to update extra information. It's still coming in at the last minute. A lot of musicians have been contacting me, and I dabble with guitar very, very little, Mickey. Like, it's a bit of a mess around I do, but like, I'm not an experienced musician, but it's musicians that hold the key for me, because these guys are advanced. And I'm only touching the surface on the acoustics, but yeah, I'd love to come back and talk about that, Mickey. JamesSwagger.com is the webpage, and I welcome any feedback.
Well, James, I look forward to it. And when I come visit you in Ireland, I'm bringing...
Please do, Mickey. Please do.
And I'm going to bring a guitar when I come, okay?
Yeah. Oh, I love musicians coming to ancient monuments.
Well, it's a mandatory state of affairs. So JamesSwagger.com, ladies and gentlemen. He is the host of Capricorn Radio and, of course, the author of the Newgrange Sirius Mystery. James, we'll have you back sooner rather than later, and a happy Samhain to you tonight.
Happy real Samhain to you too, Mickey. Take care, brother.
Thank you, brother. You take care of yourself. That's going to wrap it up for tonight's edition of the program. I am Micah Hanks along with Tyler Pittman, and we've kept you company as we always do every Tuesday night here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Fascinating guests, fascinating discussion. You may agree, you may disagree, but no doubt, no matter where you stand, right, left, middle, or perhaps on another planet, you've probably learned something when you listen to a program like The Grailian Report. On behalf of myself, Tyler Pittman, Caleb Hanks, Matthew Oakley, Chris Hayes, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, and yours truly, the Mouth of the South, I am Micah Hanks, and this is The Grailian Report.